Welcome to another program of Savoir Faire, the program about design and designers, which is being brought to you by the History of Art Department under the coordination of Dr. Giuseppe Scambri Bonacci, who is also the Artistic Director of the Indigna Biennale 2015. I am Melanie Farrugia and I will be your hostess during these programs. I remind you that the program comes with a website where you can view images of what is being mentioned during the program. The website is melfarrugia.wix.com/savoirfaire. Also, I urge you to like us on Facebook by searching Savoir Faire and also to like the Campus FM Facebook page, which you can find under Campus FM 103.7. Welcome to program 13 of the series. Today and the next three programs, we will be focused on jewelry, where we will discover more with the help of our special guest, Francesca Balzan. Francesca, how are you?
Thank you, very well.
And thank you for joining us. Maybe you can start by telling us something about you.
Sure. I'm an art historian by profession. I studied history of art at the University of Malta, did my BA honours, and then I went on to read for my MA, and it was an MA by research, which meant that I needed to choose a topic which had not been studied properly yet. So it's a bit pioneering, I suppose. You're expected to do that at MA level. And I chose jewellery. I chose a study of the history of jewellery.
And how come you chose this subject?
Well, let me start by saying that it's not because I'm a woman and I love jewellery. I'm not particularly attracted to jewellery, but what I am attracted to is the fact that there wasn't a written history of jewellery. Nobody had really bothered exploring it. Nobody had looked at it properly as an art, so it needed to be considered in the light of jewellery as an art, which was happening in Malta. Also, my interest was sparked by the fact that jewellery per se is like a piece of sculpture but in miniature, and it's functional, it can be worn, and it has meanings. It's not just worn to beautify, of course that is one of the major sort of tasks of jewellery, but also it has other meanings, perhaps religious, perhaps superstitious, and all of this really fascinated me and I wanted to know more, and this is why I ended up spending years and years researching the subject.
Yeah, surely very interesting. Francesca is also the curator of the historic museum house Palazzo Falzon in Mdina, and she was also the curator of the large-scale exhibition about jewellery that we had in Malta a couple of years ago. The exhibition was called Vanity, Profanity and Worship, Jewellery from the Maltese Islands, and was organized by Fondazione Patrimonio, which was held in the lovely venue of the Casino Maltese. I remind you that for more information about this exhibition, you can get the magnificent catalogue with images of all the exhibits, along with a number of essays about various topics related to jewellery. Also, one can get the DVD of this exhibition, which provides 360-degree walkthroughs and detailed images and information about the pieces which were exhibited. And also, the DVD contains the original music which was originally used in the exhibition. So you can almost feel that you are actually visiting the exhibition, just virtually. Francesca also published the book called Jewelry in Malta, Treasures from the Island of the Knights. Maybe, Francesca, you can tell us more how one starts researching information about a piece of jewelry.
Yes, I'll just recall years back when I had to start working on my MA, which was about jewelry, of course, the history of jewelry. There was practically nothing written about it, so carte blanche, I'm starting from zero. Well, we're lucky in Malta, we have lots and lots of archives, we really are rich in archives, so that is one help. Perhaps I should take a step back and say that before you even consider going to an archive, you have to plan your research. And I sat down literally and tried to think of all the sources that could help me in building up this history of jewellery. In my case, I was working on the knights period, so it was a limited period, although quite vast, from 1530, of course, till 1798. Essentially, my main sources were the archives, as I said. The archives contain notarial documents. If you go to the notarial archives, which means wills, dowry agreements, these are the sort of places where you'd find jewelry listed and described, and sometimes the value is there as well. But also, in other archives, I found bottega applications, which gave me an insight into who was producing jewelry in Malta, and that enabled me to understand the trade. Also, newspapers. When you look, of course, at the 19th century, this is beyond when I was doing research for the jewellery exhibition. I was focusing on the 19th century for my contribution to the catalogue. There I was looking at newspapers of the time, and we have those at the Biblioteca. So really, we are spoiled for choice. Also, apart from archives, you've got to look at the surviving pieces of jewellery. What do these tell us? Now, the ones in private collections are helpful, but usually they're mutilated. Why? Because fashions change. People leave, for example, if in the 18th century it was fashionable to have a pair of bracelets which were identical, one bracelet worn in each hand, you know, with time, you would leave your jewellery to your children, which meant that pairs got split up. Also, fashions change. Even the cut of, for example, diamonds or precious stones, the cut would change in time, and it would become fashionable to have a different cut. So some jewels were actually recut, or else they were mutilated or changed in some other manner. A earring could suddenly find itself being turned into a pendant and this sort of thing. Apart from that, Mel, of course, you have to look at paintings, because paintings will show you how jewellery was worn at the time, so that's very, very helpful. You have to look at churches, because a lot of ex voto donations were made, so people, the faithful, giving pieces of jewellery to churches, and in that case, many times they would survive intact, so quite useful. Apart from that, I suppose you've got to cast your net very widely and try and absorb as much information as you can, even from people who remember stories. All of this is important.
So I would like to mention how we will be dividing these four programs. So the first program today, it will be focused on jewelry in our lives and how various designs of jewelry were created for special purposes and special occasions in our lives, and how these items of jewelry became to symbolize these special events sometimes. So from baptism to death to an extent of jewelry as a memento after the death of the loved ones. We will be discovering some examples which were featured in the mentioned exhibition, and some images will be available in the program's website, which is melfarugia.wix.com/savoirfaire under program 13. And for those of you who wish to have more information, I remind you there is the catalog with the essays and of course all the images. The second program will be focused on five exceptional pieces, and Francesca will be telling us what research was done and the interesting stories behind them. The third program will be focused on contemporary jewelry, and also we will include some information about Andrew Grima and his daughter, Francesca Grima, and the last program will be focused on filigree. Francesca, I would like to start with the first occasion in a person's life, that is birth.
Absolutely, and jewellery features there as well. So, a person is born and a baptism is made, generally the case in a Roman Catholic country such as ours. Well, we have, nowadays at least, we connect jewellery very much with baptism gifts. We give little crosses or little precious pieces of jewellery to the child. But this tradition is actually centuries old, and I found, for example, in the 17th century a reference to a baptismal gift, un gargante che diede il padrino alla figliola nel battesimo. So there's evidence of a piece of jewellery which was given to this female child, of course, to this little girl at her baptism. later on in the 18th century, we find that not only are gifts given to the child, but sometimes even to the mother. John Ottard Montalto, in his article of Grandmasters and Grandmistresses, records this, records a gift given by the grandmaster to a mother on the occasion of the baptism of her child. Also, let's take a step back again. Let's look at pregnancy. During pregnancy as well, a mother would wear particular pieces of jewelry to protect the birth, to protect the child in future as the birth occurs. And we know that, for example, medical historian Paul Cassar and social historian José Cassar Polcino had recounted some of these traditions, and they had mentioned that at Zeytun, a ring that had been blessed on the feast day of Saint Peter Martyr, which is the April the 29th, in a church dedicated to the saint, was worn by the pregnant woman to avert an abnormal labour. So, again, they're wearing jewellery just to protect the child and to protect the process. Anyway, so the child is born, we've seen baptism gifts, and then the child starts to grow. And there's a confirmation, of course, at some stage. And during the confirmation as well, jewellery is given. Rosaries are considered part of jewellery studies, so we do consider them as jewellery historians. But also pendant crosses are given. The child starts to grow, falls in love. And of course, that's a very good excuse for more jewellery to be given. So, lots of sweetheart gifts. For example, in the 18th century, and we see this from surviving examples, but even from paintings, clasps, gold or silver, quite large, solid clasps, which have a repoussé design, that is, they're beaten from the back and there's a raised design from the front, which usually features lovebirds or a basket with flowers. They're all very sentimental. And these clasps are used for pearls or for coral beads, to tie them. They were usually worn as a pair on the hand. It's really rare to find a pair still intact. Now they've been sort of given off to other people, obviously, mm-hmm. and goodness knows what happens to the other part usually. Also, if we look at the later period, in the Victorian period, you'd get lockets. There was a period when it's called locket mania, when everybody wanted lockets and they would wear several on the body. And in these lockets, you'd have perhaps a little painting of the person you loved, or even a lock of their hair. So little mementos to remind you of the person who's close to your heart.
So these were sometimes maybe worn as pendants or on bracelets?
They could be worn either way. Generally as pendants, but they could, if they were really small, they could perhaps be worn on bracelets as well. We can look further as well at engagements in here, or betrothals, of course. In the past they would be called betrothals. And here we have a really interesting tradition that emerges from the pages of our history books. For example, in the 16th century, we know that there was a whole ritual connected with getting engaged, essentially. A man would propose his suit to a woman or to the woman's family, and once that was accepted, he would send a fish with a ring in its mouth to the future bride. She would, of course, accept, and then later, at their actual betrothal, at their actual engagement, he would give her a ring with two hands clasped together. It would feature two hands clasped together. And this is a centuries-old design, so to speak, which shows that fidelity, essentially, and the desire to become one.
So there would be two rings, or...
Absolutely. So these are the fun things that you learn about. They're little human instances, but they're recorded. Later on, we look at wedding rings, for example. The feather ring, of course, nowadays we refer to it in Italian. It's known to be a wedding ring, but obviously locally we've forgotten this term. But it was known as the anello de fidi in very old documents, and it keeps recurring. We keep finding it in documents of the 16th, 17th, 18th century. I do have some question marks about this. I'm not exactly sure what it looked like. It could have been a plain band of gold. It could have been hands clasped together. What I mean is a ring with this design mm-hmm. of two hands clasped together. But I also kept seeing in portraits of the 18th century a very particular type of ring, which generally was worn on the fourth finger of a woman's hand. And it was basically, it features a central stone and then three small stones on one side and three others on the other side, vaguely looking like a bow shape. I believe it might be a wedding ring. And how can I decide that? First of all, because of its placing on the hand and how it keeps recurring in various portraits. But secondly, I found evidence of this in descriptions in archives. Now, a document will describe in words. It's not giving you a drawing, of course. But the description seems very, very, very akin to the images that we're seeing in these portraits. So possibly I'm putting forward this hypothesis. Later on, a woman gets married, has her own house, of course, and she is the lady of the house. And one of the symbols, in a way, of owning a house and owning property and being in control of your servants, in control of your family, is the châtelaine. The châtelaine was, if you like, in modern terms, like a keychain, but it's not exactly like that at all. We have a very good example of one at Palazzo Falzon in our collection, and it is a silver châtelaine. Basically, it's like a plate, a small plate, of course, the size a bit smaller than my hand, and from it hang chains, and at the end of the chains you could have different objects hung on it, like scissors and keys and other objects which were necessary as you go about your work during the day or as you go around the house during the day. So it was really, it's like a kit that you keep on you, but at the same time, at least in the case of our châtelaine, it's silver, so it's a precious object, not intended for the servants, but for the owner of the house. And as well, it has a design on it which shows, which symbolizes love as well. So it brings together this concept of marriage, of the home, of the family, and of control over the house.
Yeah, it reminds me, of course, not how it looks, but the purpose is like having a Swiss knife, but in a more decorative and lavish way.
Absolutely. Then, of course, Mel, as you get older and death approaches, there's jewellery connected with that as well. So we've got the concept of mourning jewellery. Now, with mourning jewellery, this is perhaps one of the strongest in England. We think about England, we think about jet jewellery, which is very black jewellery, shiny black jewellery, which was worn in the Victorian period. Of course, the Victorian period was the period par excellence for mourning because of Queen Victoria or Empress Victoria at the time, who spent so many years in mourning for her husband. But in truth, the instances of mourning jewellery arise much, much earlier in previous centuries. To be fair, I didn't find much evidence of it in Malta, of mourning clothes, absolutely, veste lugubre, people wearing clothes, showing that they are in mourning for a family member who has died, but not so much with jewellery. What you do get mentioned is things like rings with skull motifs, with a skull on the bezel, on the top part of the ring. But that could be connected with the memento mori tradition, which is very, very baroque in concept. So I'm not quite sure that if we're looking at a piece of mourning jewellery. Once again, we have to look at folklore studies for evidence of jewellery worn during this period. And there has been some track of this in folklore studies, but the period is not denoted. I suspect we're looking at the 19th or even perhaps early 20th century, where it is recorded that in Malta they would wrap pieces of black cloth around their earrings during a mourning period, basically returning it black. You're turning an object black without actually ruining it, and you can repurpose, you can kind of use it later on when you're out of mourning. What I find really interesting with mourning jewellery, but this is in the international context, is, for example, people would leave money in their will for mourning jewellery to be produced after their death and worn by specific people. And we see an instance of this, for example, even in the will of William Shakespeare, who died in 1616. And there he actually, in his will of 1616, there's written that he leaves money so that rings are made and worn by specific friends of his. And this is done so that he ensures that his memory is perpetuated. People will keep remembering him. Of course, there was no need for that with William Shakespeare. We've got two in our collection, in Palazzo Falson collection, but they are English. Sometimes you would also find in mourning jewelry, you'd find snippets of hair of the person who would have died, obviously, because you want to somehow keep a connection with that person. You snip off a piece of hair on their deathbed and you put it in a piece of jewelry which you keep forever then.
Exhibition, there was also maybe more than one piece of jewelry made out of hair or with a decoration with hair. Those would be for mourning or just decorative?
Well, that's a good question, because I was talking to you about mourning jewelry, but the truth is that hair jewelry became really popular in the 19th century, and it went beyond just mourning. Many times they would create jewelry, and there was a really strong industry in the creation of hair jewelry. Of the hair of people who are alive, of course, not necessarily people's hair, but even horse hair or other types of animal hair. And they would use different colors of locks of hair to create even figurative designs. So they, you know, using these different colors, it was almost painterly. You'd actually have a design depicting something. And in that case, it goes beyond sentiment. It goes beyond mourning or particular connections with the owner of the hair. Not at all. It was just one of the materials used for jewelry, which was popular. We find it gruesome. I do, at least. I wouldn't really want to wear somebody else's hair as a bracelet, for example. But at the time, it was extremely popular. I find it interesting that you don't find a lot of evidence of it in Malta. Perhaps we are a different culture in a way, so perhaps it didn't take off like it did in England.
So we can continue by mentioning some other jewelry that features randomly in one's life. For example, ex votos.
Yes, absolutely. Ex votos are so important for the jewelry historian. I'm ever so glad that people bothered giving these gifts to churches. Why do ex votos occur? Well, first of all, generally, somebody would either have a devotion towards a particular saint, and this person would give a piece of jewelry. But generally, it happened because this person was praying to that particular saint to intercede for this person because of some trouble that was happening, or for the, if somebody was dying, some ill health, something that was a perceived great threat in that person's life. So this person would turn towards a divinity or towards a saint to help out. And if this help was received, or was perceived to have been granted, this gift was perceived to have been granted, then the person who would have promised to give a piece of jewelry, and indeed would then go and deposit this piece of jewelry in the church or in the particular chapel where prayer would have been addressed. And a lot of this jewelry survives, and it's wonderful because with churches, especially the major churches like the Cathedral Church in Imdina, they had very meticulous record keeping. So if you look in the archives, you'll find several inventories all the way from the 16th century right through to the 20th century, where people were recording every procurator who was responsible for the object under his care temporarily in the church, would then write a list to pass on to the next procurator. So they were really keeping tabs of what jewelry was there, and obviously other precious objects. Mm-hmm. But this was extremely helpful for me, so I was able to find all these wonderful inventories in the cathedral archives, and in many cases and match them up with extant pieces that have survived through the centuries, despite wars, despite melting down, despite Napoleon. jewelry has survived. Some of it has survived, and when it has survived, I was able to make to match up when the object, or at least when the object appears in the inventory, and sometimes who gave the object to the church, because this would occasionally be listed as well in the inventory, which is really helpful.
We mentioned so many items of jewelry that appear in a human's life, but what about their pets?
Yes, indeed. In fact, one of the earliest references that I came across relating to jewelry and pets actually relates to jewelry connected with Malta, with coral in particular, and this emerges from basically a poem on hunting by the Roman poet Gratius Faliscus. Now, this was recorded by Busuttil. He studied this poem and he gave context to the reference. And the reference is that Maltese coral should be placed around the dog's neck and together with some herbs and shells, and an incantation can be recited over the dog in order for it to cure if it's afflicted by rabies. But also, it could be worn preventatively. Maltese coral could be worn around the neck of a dog to prevent it from being harmed. And I find that really interesting because it's what we're doing with humans. You know, the tradition that occurs with humans, that you adorn yourself with coral, not because it's beautiful, but because you want it to protect you. But you're extending it to your dog as well. Your dog is part of your family, ultimately. And then, of course, you see jewelry on and a lot of embellishments on horses and in military parades and this sort of thing.
Thank you, Francesca, for all this interesting information. And I remind you that Francesca will be with us again next week. Enjoyed the program today, and I urge you to join us next week. This program was brought to you by the History of Art Department under the coordination of Dr. Giuseppe Scambri Bonacci, who is also the Artistic Director of the Mdina Biennale 2015. For more information about the Biennale, you can visit mdinabiennale.org and also join the Facebook page, which you can find at the Mdina Cathedral Contemporary Art Biennale 2015. For those of you who wish to either listen again to the programs, or if you missed the program, you can find them on the following website, MaltaUniversityBroadcasting.com, under the webcasts tab, and you can choose Savoir-faire. I am Melanie Farrugia, and I hope you join us next week for another program of Savoir-faire.